Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. You can also call this podcast being about films from the VHS era, though not necessarily on VHS. Our film for this episode is Peeping Tom from 1960, and we have it on VHS, getting it from the Hollywood Video on Hazelwood Avenue in Greenfield was how we got it.
What, for $5?
This is for $5 used VHS that we bought. I mean, that store closed 2008?
Something like that,
so it was in the aughts it closed. The box was still taped shut, so this is the first time we've seen this movie, I think, since renting it from Quick Flick in Ebensburg, which is a store that has been closed probably at this point now 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a film I think we learned in the 90s. It was important. Got to watch it. We watched it. Probably too young for it.
Yeah.
So here we are revisiting this film. Yeah, which I guess we should summarize the plot a little bit for sure. Folks who haven't seen Peeping Tom. You should see Peeping Tom. I should mention what our interest was piqued in seeing Peeping Tom again because of the Shudder docuseries. What's the docuseries called?
Like 101 Scary Moments in Horror Film, I believe, or yes. Something like that, yeah.
Yes, and so it's Countdown Infotainment.
There, which we fall for all the time.
Yes, it's Countdown. Other people can be smart, so we don't have to be.
Exactly.
Cool people talking about movies, and we can just sit there on the couch. But here we are talking about a movie that we were reminded of because of the Shudder thing. So basically the plot is it's a cameraman who kills people, basically. He is a peeping Tom. He has scoliophilia. That term for people who get intense pleasure out of looking at others. And so he is a cameraman who kills people with his camera.
Yep.
But he is also a professional cameraman in British film industry. And so you have this very interesting kind of double layer commentary thing where it's this idea about looking and how we, in films, watch people watch.
Yeah.
And maybe films teach us to see. And this particular character, because of his own experiences being filmed as a child by his mad psychologist father, takes out his psychosexual hang-ups on poor unsuspecting women as he films them with a camera that has a giant dagger on it. And as we find out in the end of the movie, a mirror.
Yes.
Which was the 101 scary moment. So that the people watch themselves dying as he films them die.
Exactly.
Yes. And so that's the film. And then there's a whodunit, and the police get involved, and
yeah,
that's the film in a nutshell, pretty much. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. If you're a horror fan, it is spooky season. That's why we're back from hiatus. See this movie.
Yeah.
Because it's important. It might not be good. I think that's the thing we need to talk about.
Yeah. No. It's
but it is important. And as we know, as I can say as a literature professor who had an undergraduate literature education and a graduate literature education,
yeah,
not everything that's important is good.
Exactly.
There's a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram, but it is not a perfect circle, people.
Well, you know, when it came out, it wrecked the director's career and the lead actor, the man who played Mark.
Yes.
It wrecked their careers. And so that was really hard in 1960, you know. So it was Michael Powell. The Red Shoes is probably like his most famous, or The Black Narcissist. Those two films are like hugely important films.
Yes.
That happened. And he had a ton of films prior to this movie. And then after this movie, maybe a half a dozen films happened after,
yeah,
this film.
And he was known for romantic fantasies.
Yeah.
And so the romantic fantasy director filmed, or shot or directed, I guess you'd say, the psychosexual drama film, which, strangely enough, halfway through the movie, I found myself pawing at the VHS box because I was certain this movie came out after Psycho.
No.
Because, and also in the way the Mark character,
yeah,
who is the Psycho cameraman, I mean, there's a lot of Anthony Perkins is Psycho, and there's a lot of, again, Pop Freud 101, and I was like, oh, okay, well, they saw Psycho, and it made it okay. Nope! Movies came out in the same year.
Well, you know, I think they came out in the same year, and also Powell did work with Hitchcock early in his career, and they were friends. Psycho is the better film. I think Anthony Hopkins is the better creepy guy.
Yes.
Is much better at, like, his role. And there is both voyeurism in both films.
Yes.
But a lot more violence in Peeping Tom as yes. opposed to Psycho.
Multiple kills.
And also, you know, because Hitchcock is Hitchcock, like, you know, I think Psycho, because you start with Janet Leigh and you're invested in her and what she's doing, and then he kills her off immediately.
And she was a star.
Like, I think for Psycho, like, Hitchcock just did so much to, like, jar you and to really pull you into the film. And it's a much more interesting film. And our dog agrees.
Yes, our dog agrees.
She's commenting on the film.
Yes. Yeah, and so it is also, as you said, yeah, it was a film that tanked in its own day.
Yeah.
But then, and actually, you know, the box claims it was Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Especially was a huge fan of the film. And in the 1970s, people started looking, let's look at Peeping Tom again. Because there's also, was it too early to be meta?
Mm.
Because, there is something about this film and the idea of looking, and it questions... It's a horror movie that questions maybe our need to watch horror movies.
Right.
Which maybe also is something that's a little bit of a harder ask for people. You know, the film that makes you think, maybe you shouldn't be watching this.
Well, there's this interesting part to it for me is that that she, you know, so like we're watching him watching women and filming
yes.
women and killing women. And the kind of Helen, who is his nice neighbor, who he starts a friendship with and possibly a blossoming love interest.
Yeah.
She accidentally turns on one of his films, realizes what's happening. And there's a scene where she's like, I have to see what you do to the girls. So even she
yes.
is pulled in and has to see what happened, just as we are. Like, we have to see what happens, and we have to know, because they don't reveal the kill. Like, his, you understand that he's killing them in some way, but they don't reveal the
mechanism.
There
is this giant dagger phallus thing on the cameras, but you don't get the full apparatus till the final shot.
Yes.
Or final scene of the film, I should say. Which, I guess the other part about this is this, we watched this, so this movie came out in 1960. Laura Mulvey in the mid-70s wrote the essay, the now seminal film studies essay, Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema. While it has been dated, it's dated now a little bit. I think all film study students, I think at some point you have to go through that essay,
mm-hmm.
and you have to at least acknowledge that essay. Again, seminal, important, maybe not good anymore, but interesting,
mm-hmm.
because Mulvey, from a feminist perspective, says that film teaches us to look.
Mm.
And that, especially when it comes to sex and gender, we also watch men watch women.
Gotcha.
And so that there's this interesting double effect that happens.
Right.
That while we are gazing at the film and we are definitely in control of these people as we see them, they don't get to look back at us.
Right.
We also watch men watch women.
So it's also interesting, too, when you think about it, because women make up a significant portion of
the film audience.
Of the film audience. So you have women watching men watching women.
Yes.
In it. So this
Which
like
is
whole,
part of, I think, what yeah. Mulvey did not account for.
Gotcha.
I think it's part of what comes later. Because you think even, like, when I was doing dissertation research on torture porn, that audience actually skewed female.
Mm.
For something like Hostel and Teristas.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. But it does make this argument, the Mulvey essay, which, you know, again, I think we have problems dealing with, and we have problems in this country problematizing our pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that film taught us how to look? Does it teach us what normal is, what glamorous is, what is attractive, what in the private lives of others is similar to our own private lives? you know. And when you get into gender and sexuality, it's then, you know, is this normal sex that people are having, that I'm having, or whatever, which causes these issues, which I think is all a major theme in the film, again, about 15, 16 years before the Mulvey essay.
Right.
Brings this up, because again, he's a camera, and he's also, I should mention, he is also a photographer of
pinup girls,
or
not fully pornographic.
But you have this
a Betty Page type thing.
Type pinup that maybe you have some images that go a little further.
Right.
That is implied throughout the film.
There might be some side boob. Yeah.
So there also is this element of moral panic.
Right.
Because you have this newsstand, and again, it was, there's this great scene early on in the film where this very sort of distinguished, a respectable-looking gentleman comes in and asks for, you know, two papers, and then he's like, I suppose you have other films, or other pictures. Oh, and then, you know, there's this secret binder that comes out, and then a young schoolgirl in her school uniform comes in, and he hides off at another, everybody scurries, and she buys whatever, and then he comes back and purchases the entire binder of nudies, yeah, or cuties, or pinups, or whatever. We don't get to see all of what's in the binder.
There's this moment of humor, too, because the store clerk, the store owner, is like, oh, and I'll throw in a newspaper for you.
I'll throw in those two newspapers you asked for, as they negotiate the price, and then he almost leaves without the two newspapers he asked for.
Yeah.
And they go in a giant envelope that says educational books, and then he wraps the envelope in the newspapers, which is a good reason to buy those newspapers.
Exactly.
So that he can, oh, I just have a bundle of newspapers.
It made me think of Clerks, though, with the guy asking for the nudie magazines in some way. So,
yeah.
It made me think of that scene.
Well, you know, I think it, again, is also, you know, if you have in contemporary life the nuclear family, mm-hmm, and the sort of private sphere of home.
Yeah.
And that home is divided into all these spaces. I watched this great fun documentary on sex in the Middle Ages last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, families had one room. And so, I mean, even if you're actually a king or queen, you would have drapes around your bed and your bedchamber, but there would be servants in the room. So people kind of would have sex in public, or if you wanted privacy, right, you'd go off in the woods somewhere. There was not, but the nuclear family, right, is, you know, respectable home. Well, there's a parent's bedroom, and everybody else has a bedroom, and,
yeah,
you know, you put on the white noise machine, whatever, or you wait till the kids are in soccer practice for our friends who have kids now. And it is this interesting tension because the image and pornography and cinema and all of these capacity for images,
right,
even in 1960, made sex kind of public again.
Right.
In this strange way, which is also interesting. Which is also, I think, for me, interesting in terms of seeing the film today in the era of OnlyFans, where everybody could start their own franchise,
mm-hmm,
where it's also, something happened somewhere in the world. I just saw an amazing picture of the hurricanes on Twitter. Like, you know, Douglas Copeland says this thing, you know, 9/11 was definitely the last major event that we only have a handful of images for.
Right.
And if 9/11 happened 4 or 5 years later, how many cell phone camera videos would there be? There would be videos from inside the towers.
Right.
I think
the line that you're going with, I think, you know, some part of the shock was that, so not only is he filming the murders, he's showing up at the murder scenes and filming the bodies being taken out,
yes,
and the investigation. And so he's filming everything that is happening.
Yes, he films the detectives.
He films the detectives.
When the murder happens on the movie set, he goes into the rafters and films the detectives examining the body.
And if he gets caught, he says he's filming a documentary.
Yes.
Or he's filming for, like, a local news agency or something like,
yes,
that. So I think at that time, that would have been hugely shocking, right?
And it would have been hugely shocking. And you think there's even, when he's filming the police coming to in early on in the film to one of his murder scenes. You have this great, again, meta scene where we're looking at him looking through the camera, or we're seeing his point of view, and the X-shaped sort of guidelines, framing lines, that would be in the camera sight. We're looking through his camera, where it's not just a POV shot. Again, how meta is this? We're looking through his camera.
Right.
Which is also this very uncomfortable thing for people who watch horror movies. And I'll say, you know what, even, you know, again, this desire to look and this idea of snuff being maybe the radical frontier of what you can see mm-hmm. in the world. This was the same shop that I think I rented Faces of Death from. You know, those cheesy movies. And they even had old 1950s Driver's Ed films.
Wow.
That they would show, which again was like showing death and destruction on the highway to scare teen drivers. It's that same impulse.
Yeah.
And then that same impulse becomes repulsive in this film.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think what your line of thought was saying, like, now everyone, almost everyone has cell phones, so everything is filmed.
Or filmable, potentially. Filmable
at this time. And in some ways it hits a little bit differently, because you're like, yeah, of course, like, he'd be filming it. Sure, that's what we do today, is we film things if we can film things.
Yeah.
So it hits a little bit different now, because filming is just so ubiquitous. Ubiquitous.
Like, yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you think, I mean, we all do it. I know I do it. You know, I share an image with somebody a day, or I share an image somehow every day.
Right.
But also because he is a camera person, and he has a dark room, and he has a dark room also in this apartment building that he inherited from his father, which was also the site of where he was abused, which...
So, we have to talk about that. I think,
yes.
You know, it's very Freudian in its scope, and so you have this, for me, this really awkward scene where he's showing Helen him as a young boy being filmed by his father, and his father like waking him up in the middle of the night to scare him and throwing lizards on him and doing all this other stuff. And it's like this really very awkward extended scene around being like a Freud theory, you know? And
yeah.
So that part took me out of the film a bit.
Yes.
Just because it was just so belabored in trying to make its point that, oh, the father was abusing him, and
so of course he's going to be messed up.
And there's a
scene.
He's
going to be psycho.
He's going to be psycho. And it turns out his father's a famous psychologist, and he was like, or a famous biologist, I apologize, and was doing things to see his son's response to fear, and was filming it, and did it for this kid's whole life, for Mark's whole life. And then there's this scene where, you know, the father's filming him giving Mark his first camera. So it's kind of being passed on to Mark now to do this type of thing. But that could have been like a 2-minute scene, and it went on for a really long time. And really like belabored the point. And so it was really bad, like Freud 101 psychoanalysis.
Which was
popular.
Period correct.
It was period correct. It was popular at the time. It was very popular in Hollywood to go through psychoanalyst. So it was definitely period correct. It was definitely popular at the time. But it was just almost too much.
And it is the psychoanalyst that finally opens the case and gets the police hip to Mark as the killer.
So for me, the interesting point is, so like, Mark has become infatuated with Helen, who's his neighbor, and she's like the other side of the spectrum to him. So she's very sweet, kind. She's writing a book, a children's book about cameras, and they become friends, and Mark is definitely interested in her. Helen's blind mother kind of gets something is off with Mark, and tells Mark he can...
Which, in and of itself, is this interesting, this film about seeing called Peeping Tom.
Right.
Where the blind woman is the one who has the intuition.
Who knows that there's something not right with him. And so... I lost my train of thought.
Well, I think, you know, but that belaboringness of it. And again, this, well, obviously he's messed up because he got messed up.
Oh, I apologize. So his mom, I realized where I was going with it. So the mom makes him, says, you can't see her again until you get help. Because, you know, mom realizes that he's always looking in the window and is always around.
Yes.
So she said, you can't see Helen until you get help. And so he actually does go to the psychologist for a moment. And when the psychologist says it's going to take 3 years, Mark's like, oh, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. So the getting healthier was the more difficult one. He'd prefer to just keep what he's doing.
Yeah, which is also, I think, deeply cynical.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's one of the things that I, you know, and it's still a big thing in our culture. I know sometimes when I teach a text about trauma, the students will almost sort of replicate that Dr. Drew advice or something. Oh, yeah, so you're going to be messed up forever. That something bad happened to them. They are going to be messed up forever.
Right.
Which is deeply cynical and not true.
Yeah.
But, again, is a big part of how this film works.
Yes, that's definitely a big part of how this film works. And also you think about it, too, like people who have gone through abuse and trauma, who are leading productive lives, who don't become murderers. That's also the...
Or just are nice people. I mean, that's the other thing about this film that is... interesting, or again, this is an important film. I'm still not convinced that maybe it's a good film. There's a few elements of this film that is like the world is made of glass and it is a bad windshield wiper.
Yeah.
And one of the bad windshield wipers of this movie is the fact that when Mark is triggered or Mark is acting psycho, that acting is a bit not subtle. I mean, there's a way that Anthony Perkins plays Norman Bates where he's genuinely creepy.
Yeah.
No, and there is a menace to him. The Mark character's psycho moments are borderline over the top. Borderline just so far into... I mean, it's almost like it's another clip from that Shudder series. You know, he's not far from the Renfield in the 1931 Dracula at moments. If you've seen the 31 Todd Browning Dracula, there's moments he's not that far from Renfield, but is trying to be this killer that puts women in this really, you know, vulnerable position and can kind of seduce them into being murdered, but yet he's not far from Renfield in places.
Though he is better than Brian De Palma's Raising Cain with John Lithgow.
Yes.
Which
people once took very seriously. People once took Brian De Palma. We should do a Brian De Palma movie sometime.
We should.
We would have to own a Brian De Palma movie.
We might actually have.
We might. Because it's amazing that people... I mean, even like Roger Ebert... People once took Brian De Palma. Roger Ebert, who hates everything...
Yeah.
In a really good and interesting way, thought Brian De Palma was an art tour. Also, I mean, was a huge fan of this film, actually.
So, like, Raising Cain, for me, though, is a ripoff of Peeping Tom, right? In many ways. And this, though, I do like this actually better than Raising Cain. That's true.
This is a better film than Raising Cain. And there are, I mean, as much as we've spent close to now 23 minutes ripping the film, there are places where there's genuine tension and genuine menace. I mean, there's a great scene with Helen early in the film where it's her birthday party and she leaves her birthday party to talk to Mark and she's in Mark's private lair.
Yeah.
And he could do it. And you know he could do anything to her and you know that he's not right.
Right.
That is really good filmmaking. That scene is, I mean, it's almost like even like with Marnie and a couple of the lesser Hitchcocks, there's still a couple really masterful...
Yeah.
Scenes worth seeing where they build a tremendous amount of tension.
And he's also, like, you know pretty early on he wants to get caught. So, like, it starts with his first kill. Like, that's how the movie begins, is with his first kill. He returns to the scene of the crime to film it, and he actually tosses a box of film into a trash can, or a box, for film right into a trash can right next to her apartment. And so he wants to get caught. Like, you can tell he wants to get caught. He's there. He's filming it. He's seeing what's happening. He's paying attention to what's happening. So you get a sense that he does want to get caught. And then as the film progresses, he becomes much more dangerous. Like, he becomes much more not as careful and in his kills.
Yes.
And it is setting it up that you're like, at any moment he's going to make a mistake.
When he kills people, he starts killing women in places where he is regularly.
Yes.
And places that he is associated with.
Yes. Absolutely.
There's also a great scene as he's filming the cops investigating one of his murders, and he's up in the rafters of the sound studio, and pens fall out of his pocket, and which is a very also great tension building, very sort of Hitchcockian mid 20th century filmmaking. That's really kind of fun and delightful. And I think the other thing is to piggyback on the Shudder series that I think drew our attention back to Peeping Tom. Again, I think there's also this sort of radical horror of what would it mean to watch yourself die? What would it mean to watch yourself being murdered? Which is profoundly uncomfortable.
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of what that's his kink, right? He wants to see
that degree of radical terror. I mean, also, again, the Freud thing with the...
Well, of course.
The piercing, and so it's maybe sometimes a dagger at the end of a movie camera is just a dagger at the end of a movie camera. Or is it representative of something else? But yeah, I think that element is also really profound and interesting in the film, especially in our era of surveillance, in our era when, let's face it, I mean, films have taught us how to watch, films have taught us how to make other films. All of that is fascinating and interesting. And so, again, this movie is important because it asks these sort of strange meta questions for a horror movie to call into question, well, why are you watching this? Are you Mark as well?
Right. Right. And it's realist, right? So, like, you think about, like, and that you think about Hammer films coming out of England, which was so over the top, right?
Like, so cheesy. Love Christopher Lee, but his Dracula.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the that is right. That is one thing about the film. Some of the scenes where Mark is being psycho, it's overcooked.
Right.
But you think even Bela Lugosi's Dracula, if you step away from the anti-Semitism of it and you just look at it objectively, he's over the top. But again, would the original audience have just, oh, Jews are scary, you know, and then, like, they would have just got it or picked up on the Star of David that he's wearing and stuff like that. You know, we're supposedly a little more sophisticated now. There's not a lot of distance. There's not a lot of practical effects in this film.
Right.
There's not makeup. There's not an the inhuman monster is a human.
Right.
As opposed to a creature.
Right.
Or something. Or a giant bug or, you know, whatever, radiation. That, so there's very little distance from the horror. Which, you know, you made a good point when we just, as the tape was rewinding, you said about how, you know, this was also that period in the middle of the century where, you know, the ghost of World War II is still hanging low over the world, especially over Europe. And thinking like, well, how could this happen? How could people be so inhumane? And so that's part of the element then, and I think it's maybe still with us a little bit too.
Absolutely.
So, are we ready for the four big questions?
Sure.
I think, is that it? All right. Question one. Is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
I think it's an important film. So,
that's not one of the four choices. I was thinking the same thing. And also I was thinking, wow, I wish there was five choices.
I'm going to say...
Camp, retro, classic, important movie, or just an old movie.
I think... For me, I'll say I do think it borders a little... Oh, see, it borders a little bit in camp in some ways, but I'm going to go for classic.
Yeah, I agree. Again, if you're a student of cinema, if you're a student of horror movies, even if you are not entertained by the film, you should see the film. Because also I think you can see the influence of the film in other places, especially like
Killer last POV. Night, I was going to say Last Night in Soho kind of has that vibe.
Oh,
has
yes.
very much a similar vibe to it. And a similar vibe to like what kind of women were going through at that time, right? You know, so for me, there was a few parts of the film where I was like, wow, this really makes me think of Last Night in Soho.
Yeah.
The vibe around it.
Absolutely.
I do want to bring up something I think is interesting, though, is that I do want to make an argument that Helen is a final girl.
Okay.
Which I think is why it makes it more of a classic for me.
But here's the thing, though. She's an incredibly passive final girl. She's a final girl who doesn't, like, outrun, outplay, outwit, or kill the monster.
Well, this is what I'm gonna say. You know, so there's the 1992 book Men, Women, and Chainsaws,
which is right over there on the shelf behind you.
Carol Clover, where she talks about the final girl. And so typically people will argue about Laurie Strode or Sally, Laurie Strode from Halloween or Sally from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre being the final girl. I'll argue that Jess in Black Christmas is also should be considered in that group. But in an article from Vox, they actually talk about Psycho and Lila, was it Lila? Lila, the sister,
mm-hmm.
being a final girl. I would also potentially put Helen as a final girl in the sense like she's virginal, she's kind and sweet. What saves her is that she's obviously not like running around and sleeping around with people. Like she is pure, is what saves her.
Yeah.
Purity saves her. And he keeps saying, like, don't look at me, don't look at me, I don't want to harm you, that her purity. I would say she's an early final
okay.
girl. And the thing I think is about interesting about it is that Nightmare on Elm Street, you could say she kind of knows the killer. I don't think she knows the killer. She figures out it's Freddy. Where for this, the next film where the person knows the killer intimately would be Scream, which is in the 1990s. So that was also kind of interesting for the time. Helen knows her killer, knows that her potential killer. It's her friend, it's her neighbor, it's a person she likes. And so Scream being considered like a meta modern horror film.
Yeah.
And you know, she knows him. Sydney knows the two killers. She's friends with them. She's in a relationship with one. So I think it's kind of interesting that in 1960, that was being thought of, right? And she is very much different than the other women he encounters. Because he's, you know, he kills a prostitute. He kills one of the pinup Betty Page girls. He kills a film extra who is very flirtatious. And obviously dates a lot, and she's very, you know, stays late to be with him. So she's very much different than those other women. She's living with her mom. She's writing a child's book. So I think actually, like, it should be considered as a potential prototype for the final girl. But it's, I think because it's British, people would never
Yeah. I think that makes sense, but I think maybe this also then lovelily transitions into the question two of the big four,
mm-hmm.
which is what about the social political distance, and what do we do with the sort of latent misogyny of the film, and is it just embodied in Mark, or is it embodied in the whole film, that it is these women who, by the women being sexually expressive, they are the women that he kills?
Right, so it's like right at women's liberation, right?
Yeah, right, so 1960, that is also then Second Sex.
Second Sex, exactly. And you think about it, like, the girl, the film extra, other than, like, a guy asking her out, there's no other hint. They just, you just assume. So I think a 1960 audience would be like, oh, she's, that girl's a little loose. She's wearing pants, and she's dancing in front of a boy.
Yes.
Like, there would have been that connotation with it. And even the pinup girl is like, fully dressed, actually, the whole time. She's just in a top.
Well, There's a couple scenes where the Pennant girls, there's some skin. There's also this really, again, you just feel so dirty. Said something like, I found my, you know, I was out with my boyfriend and bumped into my fiancé. And she's like, oh, could you make sure they don't see the bruises?
Right. No, you're right. You're right.
Which is, man.
Well, you know, it also...
CD.
Yeah. Well, also now I'm thinking about, if you have not watched Last Night in Soho, check out Last Night in Soho. You know, it's also like watching that film and then watching this film is kind of interesting because, you know, the way women were being exploited at that time and they might not have an option to get out of that exploitation.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Last Night Soho, she finds a way out of that exploitation in a very severe way. And so for me, it's kind of these two interesting films because I think there's a sense of if you're a 1960s audience, you're watching it and saying loose women and it's very misogynistic. And but now in Last Night in Soho, I'm like, these are actually women being exploited and treated in this way and now being punished for being caught in a situation they can't get out of.
Yeah.
And so it's also kind of, that's gross, right?
Like
women being punished for just being kind of, you know, interested in sex and things like that.
So what about question three, the technical distance, or we call it the room test?
So I think it's funny because we talked about cell phones, right? Like, but in the sense of a movie making process, it's still like very much how movies are made, right?
Yes.
Which is kind of funny to me. So like in that sense, the technical distance is very similar, right?
Yeah.
The cameras are smaller and things like that, but that's very much how a film set would run. And that's very much how, you know, how many, that's, you would have all these people involved in the filmmaking process. He has a portable camera, which is, he can carry in his coat, which would be a precursor to, well, to having the, like, camcorders, but then to cell
phones. To having camcorders, to having the flip cam, to having cell phone cameras.
Right. But so he has a portable recording device, which was kind of interesting, especially for that time.
Yeah.
That would have been really new. So in that sense, like, the film within the film, because there's a film is being made in this, well, the multiple films are being made within this film. So within the film, that process of filmmaking stays the same.
Yeah.
So it still feels kind of like very similar to what you would see. But of course, in terms of like, you know, you're not seeing cell phones and you're not seeing
that, but I think, there's ways also because the film is so focused on storytelling and that character. Again, there's not a lot of practical effects for the film.
No.
I mean, though there are, people are killed with a tripod dagger type thing. There's very little blood in the film. Which also helps keep the film fresh in terms of you just go, okay, it's the 60s. They don't have cell phones, whatever. The movie still visually holds up, I think, in terms of technically, even if there's not modern, quote-unquote, technology in it. But again, this fascinating, like, he just has a room in his giant apartment house that he owns that is a dark room, film screening room, that it has the power of the device that we carry around in our pocket.
So I always think it's interesting. Now, and I love horror films, and I do, you know, there's horror film directors I like. I think, though, sometimes you get a better horror film when it's a person who, that's not the only thing they do.
Yeah.
And so, like, you think about Kubrick and The Shining, like, how much tension is built in that film just by shadows and reactions and things like that. There's a lot of tension built into it. And
yes.
I think it makes a difference because it's a person who is not typically in the horror genre making this film. And so I think when you're a director who has like a broader scope, that sometimes pays off really well.
Which maybe is the other way that this film, you know, it is sort of an odd duck.
Yeah.
In that in its own time, it still doesn't necessarily follow horror film conventions, doesn't feel like a horror film.
Right.
Which
now,
so
though, people are breaking out of horror film conventions. Right?
Yeah, so, which again is why this movie's important.
Right.
So will we ever watch it again? Question four.
Yeah, you know, yes. And I think it's so funny because Martin Scorsese just said he really liked Pearl. And yes. So, which is kind of interesting. So you have Peeping Tom on this end, and now Pearl.
Which is another movie about movies. Another horror movie about movies.
And also women being exploited and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of interesting, like, Martin Scorsese was like, hey, check out Pearl. And then in the 70s, he's like, hey, check out Peeping Tom. And so, like, you know, his influence is going to cause people to go and see things. So I think it's an important film. I think it's a film that I would revisit again and watch again. Not like The Changeling or Rosemary's Baby that I could once a year watch.
Maybe in the 2040s.
It's not one that I would be like, oh, you know what? It's been like 8 months since I watched The Changeling. Let me watch The Changeling again.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. If you know, not that we watch much TV at this point, but if it's like it's a day like today on a Saturday, oh, Changeling's on AMC. We're watching The Changeling. That's exactly it. We might have had plans. We're watching The Changeling.
Which The Changeling was not as high up in the 101 scariest moments for Shudder. But I think, which bothered me.
But hey, that's the fun of the 101 countdown.
Right, you get whatever. To argue.
You get to argue. They beg to be argued with. People saw the Pitchfork 100 best, 150 or 250 best songs and albums of the 90s. They want you to argue with it.
But
they made a bad list so that you can argue. You can have the satisfaction of arguing with it. It's part of the game now.
But I would revisit it. I would watch the film again. It's not a film that I would say, like, Marnie, I don't think I'd ever watch Marnie again because of
Better Hitchcocks.
There's better Hitchcocks and that weird dynamic and that relationship. I would revisit this again, but not on a regular basis. How about you?
I've seen it.
You've seen it. You're good.
I think I might be good. Unless I was writing about it because, you know, Laura Mulvey came back and I had a conference paper opportunity, then we're down, you know. But, yeah.
I think we're done.
I think that's it.
All right. I think our last statement is you should watch it, but it's probably not going to be in your regular canon.
Yes. But you should watch it.
You should watch it. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.